Hello and welcome to the front page. We've just had 5 days of scintillating racing that made the Mercury look modest. It was Royal Ascot, British racing at its very best. And in Field of Gold, we had a superstar who lit up the meeting and provided us with a superstar for the flat season. But there were talking points galore, from outsider victories to Wathnam's dominance. And of course, small matter of the heat wave, sock gate and the dress code. To talk about all of that and so much more, I am your host, Racing Post editor Tom Kerr. I'm joined in the studio by James Stevens and John Harding, and we are going to get straight to it, gentlemen. We're going to start at the top with Field of Gold, who lit up the opening day, definitively showed that that Guineas performance, that 2000 Guineas performance, was not the real him, and potentially announced himself as the most exciting flat horse in many years. What do we make of it, James?
I thought Field of Gold put in one of the most outstanding performances I've seen for a long, long time. To use Racing Post ratings, there's only been 130 plus RPRs recorded by Baid and Gayef. So he's second on that list. So already in his career, he's produced a bit of a monster performance. And I think with racehorses, you often get horses that travel very well into their races and horses that finish very strongly. He had both. He travelled so well under Colin Keane, who always looked in absolute cruise control. And when he said go, it was instant. He put the race to bed and made a field look very average when directly behind him, he had two classic winners, the English Guineas winner and the French Guineas winner in second in Henri Matisse. So outstanding. Is he the best judgment horse since Frankel now? Possibly. You might have to say that. Yeah. Obviously, Enable got £7. So on ratings, it wouldn't be her. And his form of his St. James's Palace Stakes win was better than Kingman, so yeah, he certainly looks to be going to the right places, and he's that horse that's going to bring flat racing exciting in the summer. You know, how good is he going to be? What's he going to do against the older horses? Is that point in the season where the older horses meet the three-year-olds? I don't know how strong the three-year-old form will turn out to be. The Derby was a race full of non-stayers. The Guineas was a race full of mile and a quarter horses. And there's only been a few actual milers and actual mile and a half horses. So I'm fascinated to see how the season goes. But Field of Gold, take nothing away from him. His performance on Tuesday was outstanding.
Yeah, and that RPR of 131 really does sort of put him in a very rarefied company. Indeed, he's still £12 behind Frankel at his peak, but we would expect that at this stage. Just how good might Field of Gold be?
I mean, I said after his Irish Guineas that it was a type of performance that made me wish I was several stone lighter and able to ride racehorses, because it's
a lot closer than some of us.
Well, it was just how fun must that be when you press go on a horse like that and they go and just find another gear, and you can kind of get caught up in the RPRs are important in the analysis and the comments afterwards, but just visually stood watching that race from the grandstand was a real treat. You can just, the eye test was this, we're watching something special.
It was electrifying, wasn't it? That acceleration, the distance immediately put between him and the rest of the field, you know you're watching something quite extraordinary when you see that.
Yeah, and you could see around as well. You know, you don't have to be somebody who works in racing or follows the sport that closely to know that you've witnessed something as a sheer sporting spectacle that was a little bit different. And that's exactly what he is. He's a little bit different. I think occasionally there is this urge to kind of big up horses quite soon in their careers, and we get excited about them quite rightly, but I think it's entirely justified with him. I think he's the horse of this season, certainly so far. Mm. And as James alluded to there, when he takes on his elders, it could be quite exciting.
Well, speaking of which, stablemate, Ombudsman, RPR of just £1 lower than Field of Gold registered in the Prince of Wales. I mean, who knows if they'll actually clash, but you know, we have a ready-made sparring partner right there. That would be an absolutely electric race if it happened.
It would be, and kind of after Ombudsman, that was the question put to John Gosden: how about those two going at it in an Eclipse or in a Judmon or wherever they might potentially end up if they step up and trip? And I don't know if the trainer would necessarily be that keen on having to run them both against each other, but as a fan, you'd love to see it, wouldn't you? Because I think Ombudsman's, that turn of foot he has, that is something, you know, I think that makes him an interesting opponent for Field of Gold. I don't think it would be as straightforward as Field of Gold is just the better horse. I think Ombudsman is, you know, he would be a very interesting opponent for him.
I think It's fair to say they're not going to be rushing to pitch the two into battle together. But come on, they've got it. They've got to face each other at some point, don't they, James?
The Judmont is the place where it's probably going to happen. Field of Gold, I think the exciting thing with him as well is the way he races allows himself to get further, get a mile and a quarter, because it's just a case of travel with him and then pull away. And so that's going to be the obvious place because of not only the fact that he's owned by Judmont and they sponsored the race, but also we're always thinking of commercially now. You know, what races would you want to win with an eye to becoming the most valuable stallion? And a mile and a quarter is a bit of a golden distance now. So I could definitely see the two of them there. And my word, I'd definitely want to be in the Field of Gold camp. I thought Anderson was a good winner. Have looked very good, but they went very fast in that race. And the race was set up for us. Los Angeles, who was proven form over further, they went hard, and it was always going to be a case of who's going to finish best. And he is the best. He was the best horse on the day for that. Quite incredible that only yesterday, as we record here on Monday, Omnisman made his debut at 18-1 and won. Mm. So he's come a long way in a short space of time. Credit to them. But yeah, I'm Field of Gold over Omnisman every day of the week.
And quickly, yourself, John?
Yeah, Field of Gold, I think. But yeah, at the same time, what I'm trying to say is I don't think it's clear cut. I think Ombudsman, yeah, for all he is an older horse, is also very lightly raced, and there's any amount of improvement potentially for him. And I think he's better value than the winning distance because he had a few traffic problems and still kicked on and won it quite impressively. So two exciting horses.
Very much so. And what a meeting for the Gosdens. Gosh, this was their sort of post-Tory resurgence after a very quiet year last year. Five winners across the week under four different jockeys. They got the top trainers title. It's a full-scale return to the top table.
Yeah, the Godolphin winner, Trawlerman and Omnisman is pretty significant as well, because they're not connections you necessarily always associate with the Gosdens. So to be able to reward them may mean they get more horses in the future from them. Who knows how it's going to work out. Yeah, and as you mentioned, Field of Gold. I mean, at this point in the season last year, the Gosdens hadn't had a two-year-old winner. Mm. Field of Gold was their first in July. So if you think about a year ago compared to now, how things have changed, you know, it was a bit of a... There's been a few defeats, it was a little bit down, and you're questioning this powerhouse yard, and suddenly they've come back. That's the great thing about this sport, is that in just a few days and just a few winners, everything goes full cycle, and that's been the case. I mean, Trawlerman, you mentioned the Gold Cup. It was a pretty weak Gold Cup. He was a good winner. He was the only horse that stayed the distance, I think.
Great ride.
It was a great ride. Well, yeah, I, to be honest, if I might not need to be three stone lighter. I thought he was the only horse that stayed the distance, to be honest, other than Dubai Future, who probably needs about 4 miles to finally finish with a good distance. But Trawlerman, fair play to him. You know, he's been on the go for a while and deserved his Gold Cup. He's the best horse, but it would be nice to see Kyprios there.
Let's move on to the power plays that are the great superpowers and their performances at Royal Ascot. Because this is a meeting that always tells us something about where the balance of power rests in racing. And I think it's fair to say that we sort of saw the tectonic plates shifting a little bit this year, John. Because Wathnan Racing, which was only registered in Britain a few weeks before the 2023 Royal meeting, had five winners. That's a real statement week for them. This is the racing operation, of course, of the Emir of Qatar. Not someone who's short of a bob or two, I think it's fair to say. And they've gone out, they've bought big, they've really spent prolifically. And this was a week it all sort of came together for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's crazy. I remember being at that Royal Ascot when they had three runners and two winners, Courage Mon Ami and the Gold Cup, thinking, who are these guys, yeah, really? We saw they were making...
At that point, I don't think we even knew who was behind them.
No, there was a lot of reporting that went
into it. James Thomas, our sales editor, who sort of unearthed that this was, it's the Emir of Qatar, of course.
And they'd had a presence abroad, and I think they might have had a runner in France before they had one in Britain, but this was suddenly this emerging superpower. And now you can just take the emerging off the front of that. They are the superpower. They are one. They, I think they are in that conversation with Godolphin and Coolmore now.
Yeah.
Because they're not just spending money, it's the strength in depth, it's how competitive they were right across the week. It wasn't one really expensive horse putting them on the map, or I suppose that the only thing now will be their business model, whether that evolves, I think, off the back of this, because it's very much we target these horses ahead of the big meetings, spend a lot of money. They've got maybe a couple of broodmares now. It's another step when you start getting into stallions and a full operation like that. But as far as progress goes, after 2 years, I'd say they would have taken where they are now.
And fair play to their buying team? Because, look, it's obviously an easier job to get yourself to the top table when you are the monarch of a petrostate. But it's not easy, and as the old joke goes, the how do you make a small fortune in racing? Start with a big fortune. So, you know, this is not a guaranteed route to the top, but they've bought shrewdly.
Yeah, they have. They seem to have a really good team there, and they're it's not a case of just going in and throwing money at horses. They're quite selective in the types of horses they're buying. There is method to the madness, if you will, and clearly it's paying off, as it did this week.
James Godolphin had a reasonable week, but their main man, Charlie Appleby, had a really tough time, and it was only on the last day that indefatigable international campaigner, Rebels Romance, finally snapped his drought that goes back, 2022, his last winner, extraordinary.
You talk about the game, how it changes. I mean, you're talking first week of the season, Charlie Appleby's won both guineas. You're thinking, well, this could be a massive season. I mean, I was even looking at the Trainers' Championship thinking maybe he could be a bit of value here. And that's racing. You know, Royal Ascot is extremely hard to get winners. We talk about Wafnan buying them. And just on Wafnan, I mean, this is anti-post betting on a different scale, isn't it? Yeah. They're looking at horses in advance going, I think that's going to win this race. I'm thinking, let's invest big, because these horses won't be going cheaply. They'll be going very expensively. So credit to Wafnan, because finding these horses and being able to buy your way into winner's circle at Royal Ascot is a massive thing. And above all else, I mean, there was a little bit of frowning when they first came into racing. It was, they've just spent big, oh, here's somebody else spending big in racehorses. But they've invested year on year and had that success, which is not always the case. A lot of people buy big, they explode onto the scene and disappear quite quickly. Wafnan has actually evolved over a period of time, so credit to them. But back on Godolphin, I mean, Rebel's Romance, what a horse. He's like a jumper. He just returns year on year. He's tough, he's hardy, he gets there, does the job done, and goes all over the world. I mean, Godolphin will have some of the sexiest racehorses, all these flashy pedigrees and stuff, but my word, he is hardy, he's tough, he's absolutely everything you'd want in a racehorse. And I was delighted that on that Saturday, he really got the recognition he deserved, because he's been running in all these races, which are huge races, but like the Breeders' Cup Turf, it's not the big race on the Breeders' Cup, and he's been winning all the races abroad, which don't get quite the coverage here. Saturday was his day, he got the respect he deserves. He's an absolute cracking racehorse, and credit to Connections to keep him going for so long.
Let's talk Coolmore quickly as well, because they were top owners on Countback from Wafnan. But no group ones, including, you know, a notable disappointment with Los Angeles, who didn't run a great race, went too hard early. But they were dominant in two-year-old races. Charles Darwin in particular looked very special. Is that setting up a big 2026?
You'd have to say so. The two-year-olds did look very, very good. And Tom Segal on our Good Morning Royal Ascot show made a really interesting point that he thinks Coolmore are going to continue to dominate because the pedigrees are so much better than what else is on show at Royal Ascot. And it certainly proved the case. I mean, those group winners on the two-year-olds look very good. We know how much Aidan O'Brien thinks of Charles Darwin. We don't know what Albert Einstein's going to be, because after the race, immediately the talk is, well, if this is how good Charles Darwin is, and I think he could win the Nunthorpe, I think he's that good. O'Brien's saying, well, we've still got this Albert Einstein at home who's so good, who knows how good he's going to be. So there's this whole excitement bubbling away. Credit to Coolmore. I mean, there was no Group 1 winner, but I don't think they'll be disappointed, because they've shown what they've got to come. And if you're Coolmore, if you're Godolphin or Wafnan, you'd be quite scared, because they look very good, these two-year-olds.
They're missing a few big names, to be fair. You know, Kyprios being retired, you'd say if he ran anywhere near his best, you'd say he probably would have won the Gold Cup. And then there's a few other horses like the Lake Victorias and things. So I wouldn't be too worried for Aidan O'Brien just yet.
It's still one of the great oddities of racing that Coolmore, despite their enormous firepower, their enormous investment in the best pedigrees, don't seem to get horses like Field of Gold, the sort of potential superstars. It's often sort of said, you know, has Aidan O'Brien ever really trained a truly great horse? And depending on how you assess it, then, you know, the various candidates can be put forward. But nonetheless, it seems to be the likes of Judmont and others. But I think that's a subject for another day, because I want to touch last of all on your mate Kia, John. Amo had a a tricky week. They've spent incredibly big over the last few years. They spent $62 million at the sales last year. They're still splashing the cash. Spent $2 million on Ghost Rider on the eve of Royal Ascot. No winners for that investment this year. Will it come good, or are they just fishing in such deep waters that even that kind of expenditure is going to fall just short?
It's hard to say, isn't it? Ammo understandably get a lot of headlines because they're coming in and investing heavily, which is a good thing. And they're taking on some pretty established powers as the new kid on the block. I think, such is the nature of the investment, I don't think it, similarly to Watnan, I don't think it is just a case of throwing money around. I think there is a plan here with buying the yard in Newmarket, with having a trainer, so I think there is strategy behind it. I don't think it is simply just a case of, you know, we want to lose as much money as quickly as possible. They had some horses run well at Ascot, I think maybe just didn't quite get the rub of the green, so I wouldn't be too worried there. As for long term, the proof will be in the pudding, I suppose. But there's a lot of the groundwork, I can see the logic in it. So I wouldn't say it's a case of, you know, just a haphazard approach to it all.
Yeah, and it certainly is commendable, isn't it?
I mean, absolutely,
they're going up there. They are trying to go into battle against established operations like Coolmore, as well as those like Godolphin and Watnan that are backed by the wealth of nations.
Yeah.
You know, this is not easy at all. And they're giving it a real good rattle.
They are, and, you know, Keir is a character, clearly, but he will front up, he will talk to the media, he has some interesting opinions, and, you know, you need that. You need a little bit of variety. You need a slightly disruptive force, I think, because it would get slightly boring if it was the same old people all the time winning.
People find them interesting.
Yeah.
And they were a whisper away from winning the Commonwealth Cup as well, so
yeah,
it wasn't completely a bad week for them.
On such small margins, turn a week, as my punting can testify. But let's turn to that punting roller coaster, because Royal Ascot didn't just deliver blue bloods and massive operations. There were also some fairy tales and upsets in there. We had Docklands winning the opener, £16,000 purchase, downing Hot Pot Rosalian and giving Harry Eustace a unbelievable start to his week that just got better. We had Jim Goldie representing Glasgow, not something that's often said, unless I'm representing Glasgow, but not in the winner's enclosure. He had American Affair in the King Charles. We had 33-1 Circene landing the Coronation Stakes. Does this sort of fairy tale cut through more than the big yards, the big horses winning?
I think so, because Royal Ascot, on a wider scale, is an event, and a lot of media will cover Royal Ascot because it is Royal Ascot, and they'll look for stories that really resonate. And Waffnans, Godolphins, Coolmores, great horses, they're good stories, but it's the lesser angles, it's the local angles, it's the cheap buys with a dream, the fairy tale stories. That's what sets racing apart, and that's the stories that, if you look through the great racing tales of year on year, they always go back to those fairy tale stories. I mean, Jim Goldie, what a great story that is. You really can't knock that.
I loved it, because Jim is one of the nice guys, and you know, you get him on the phone, he's one of those people you could pass half an hour chatting away, but he was basically speechless. He couldn't quite comprehend that he'd done this. It was a real reminder of the magic of Royal Ascot.
Exactly, yeah, and you're looking at trainers who you more associate with standard meetings, midweek racing, and so then to see them thrown into the group ones, and it's all about them, the attention's on them, the focus on them, it's lovely to see. And you mentioned Docklands. I mean, what a week for Harry Eustace. I mean, two Group 1 winners at Royal Ascot.
Incredible.
And O'Brien didn't have
one. He had a handful of runners. They all ran extraordinarily.
They all ran extremely well. Yeah. And this is a trainer who's emerging so quickly. And to get winners at Royal Ascot is such a huge thing, because it attracts the attention of the world. We know who's watching. And his first winner was for OTR Racing, who's huge in Australia. They obviously know David Eustace, his brother, who's so successful down there. And just those few winners keeps that eye on you, and when that's so important in jumps racing. And I think the other big winner this week, which won't get the recognition, was two winners for Willie Mullins, because this is a guy who we know is dominant over jumps. Everyone's aware of how brilliant he is over jumps here, but on a global scale, he's really announced himself in a Royal Ascot once again, saying, look, I can do it with the flat horses. Because the one race which I think over here, still is so intriguing as the Melbourne Cup. So many trainers want to win the Melbourne Cup, more than any. And so Willie Mullins winning those two staying races, the Ascot Stakes and the Queen Alexandra, that was a big result. And the fact he won them for OTI Racing, that's going to be potentially huge for his chances of doing the unthinkable and win the Melbourne Cup.
We will certainly see Willie back down under again. Just a quick word on the sort of punting balance. Certainly wasn't a bad week for favourites, despite some of these underdogs coming through. We had 14 favs winning from 35 races. If you'd backed them all, you got a 28% profit on investment, which is not bad at all. How do we assess Ascot's competitiveness? Because obviously it's a huge focus at Cheltenham.
I think it's always stood up. That meeting has always stood up. I think I need to double check this really, but I think there was only two races with fewer than eight runners. Wow. I think I read this morning from somebody from Ascot. So that in itself speaks volumes. And there aren't loads of odds
on. I'm amazed there was that many, actually.
There aren't loads of odds on shots either. You know, even Field of Gold, we're not talking long odds on shots. Even the favourites are backable prices, really. So yeah,
I think the average SP of those winning favs was about 5-2.
Exactly. So it's always been a competitive meeting because it is the one that everybody targets. There is no one dominant force in the way there is over jumps. So that makes it a more compelling from a sort of punting perspective. Whether that was borne out in the betting ring in terms of the actual volume staked, I'm not entirely sure. But in terms of the competitiveness, it's right up there.
And one of the things that really makes Ascot what it is the global influence, the fact that the runners from all around the world. They had a fairly tough week, the global runners. I think this is most brutally illustrated by the week of Jérôme Regnat, who had Lazat winning in great style on Saturday. But before that, was very disappointed by Factor Cheval in the Prince of Wales Stakes and blasted Flavien Prat with some of the most eye-catching assessments of a ride I think we've ever heard. He told our Scott Burton, who is our Paris correspondent, the horse has come out of the race well, despite his jockey doing absolutely nothing to help him. I think it was perhaps the worst ride given to one of my horses since I became a trainer. In a race with loads of pace, he elected to lead the chase. He was the first to commit on the turn for home and turn for home and launched his attack three wide with no cover and too far out. He thought he was at Santa Anita or Del Mar, where they have short straights and the tracks are flat. I don't think it was a judicious move to use a jockey who rides in that style. Fair comment?
That's his opinion, isn't it? You can't argue with it. They did go way too hard in that race. It was just silly. It was always set up for an ombudsman. So that's why I'm so cynical about the form of that race. I'm going to try and take it on because I don't really believe it. Look, we don't hear jockeys berated very often. It got a lot of attention because it's so rare. My immediate thought reading that was, do you remember when we were in here talking about miking up jockeys?
Yeah.
And trainers, you would love to hear what is really said. I mean, racing is a very good PR department in every yard. You know, every yard is, everything's good. But listen, I've been to parade rings many a time and jockeys have been absolutely ripped into. You know, it does happen. Whether it quite needs to be in public, whether it quite helps anyone, I'm not sure. But anything that gives a punter and the fans of a sport a real insight into how people are really feeling and just away from that sort of plastic seal of what we should and shouldn't say is always interesting. Probably not the best ride, but it's flat racing. It's racing. How things change. 2 days later, he's won a Group 1.
I think racing kind of needs this stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, why not?
You know, we tiptoe around bad rides and poor performances, and the sport is almost allergic to causing offence. But you know, this story got picked up everywhere. You know, the Mail picked it up, the Sun picked it up. It did the yards that probably no other story at Royal Ascot did, which is illustrative of the fact that a little bit of controversy, a little bit of emotion and passion really does capture the imagination.
Absolutely, yeah. And there is a lot of tiptoeing, and I've always found that frustrating because as you watch other sports, you watch footballers get analysed all the time. If they have a run of bad games, they get called out for it quite publicly. Now, obviously, within a reasonable you know, within reasonable limits. You don't want to go too far and start getting personal and this, that and the other, but I do think it's fair game, and I think, you know, it's an elite sport and performances, good or bad, should be analysed the same.
Last word on the global appeal of Ascot. We obviously had a decent spread of runners, including one from Japan, second, they've still yet to get their breakthrough. But the track's director of racing, Nick Smith, warned today, talked to Racing Post, that we're trying to sell racing at Royal Ascot, which is run for a significantly lower level of prize money than 90% of the races we're competing with internationally. And that is the case, of course. You know, Royal Ascot, you know, really healthy prize money, but by comparison to those big Middle Eastern meetings, by comparison to the big Australian and Hong Kong meetings, never mind Japan or even America, it's a minnow in prize money.
It is, and I think Ascot is hanging on to the fact that it's such a great tradition and the event is so fantastic that you want to come here and have a runner, and the idea that British racing is the core place for racing, where it all sort of all started, and come here and have a winner, and that sort of that value is what's a huge driving force to why you'd have runners. Because if you're thinking financially, you'd be crazy to come here. What is the point? You know, yeah. the money isn't great.
Got to hire a top hat.
You got to hire a top hat and all of that. Whereas you could go to this, you could go to Saudi, you could go to Dubai, you can go down to Australia, as you rightly say, and America for the international program is extremely rich, and you can get. I mean, we talk about international runs, so Turner Rev, I mean, this is a horse that's been around the globe. You know, he's been running into Kai Ying Rising, the world's best turf horse, and my word, was a pretty big form boost for that horse. We already know how good he is. I mean, this horse has been running all over the world. I mean, the money on Saturday would be nothing compared to what you'd be getting at elsewhere. So it's a hard sell, and to make British racing more attractive on a global level, the prize money is a part of it. But I also feel that maybe the programme has to benefit horses in another way. For example, a bonus scheme if you were to run at Royal Ascot and then win at York or something, or link the two together to try and build the international runners. Because having runners at Royal Ascot still does have an appeal. It's the place where people want to be recognised. It's watched by the world. It's huge. And that's what Royal Ascot will always have. But it's about British racing being clever and going, OK, right, we've got a great horse here who's coming over for Royal Ascot. How can we try and make that an advantage so that the horse doesn't just come over one race and go home? Let's keep this horse in Britain to run at York and have this horse running in Britain throughout the season. And things like bonuses, increased money, increased incentives is the way forward, because the prize money is clearly not on the level that you're going to get around the world. But it must be said is that Royal Ascot deserve a lot of credit because the event still has that much appeal that even that the prize money isn't worth competing for compared to those other jurisdictions, it's still got that huge pull.
Well, let's turn to what happened off the track, because as ever with Royal Ascot, what happens away from the turf is often as noteworthy or certainly as interesting and talked about as what happens on it. First of all, we had the crowds, John, because the total attendance was 286,000, which is up 5% year on year, and a record 71,000 coming on the final day. Why does Royal Ascot thrive when other major meetings, particularly Cheltenham and the Derby, are struggling so much?
I think it's to do with where it sits culturally, myself. You know, I think it is up there with a British Grand Prix, with a Wimbledon, as an established date in the social calendar, alongside being an established date in the sporting calendar. I think it transcends the sport in a way. I think it is one of those events that is its own thing, it's its own entity. It picks up, you know, there's interest in the carriages, the King and Queen are there. It's larger than just racing, I think. It has that position, whereas the Derby used to occupy that position. It used to be a day everybody had marked in their calendar every year, I think less so now. Whereas Royal Ascot has endured because of its history, because of the pageantry, because a lot of those people there probably watched one race and dressed up and just enjoyed the occasion. That's why I think it transcends myself.
Yeah, what do you think, James? Because I think there's a lot of truth in that, but then of course Cheltenham has a pretty established point certainly in the sporting calendar, and yet it's really seeing crowds sort of drop off a cliff almost over the last few years.
That's true. And I think those of us who love Cheltenham Festival will be watching that, scratching our heads going, OK, well, Why is this happening? Especially as we all think Cheltenham Festival is the best over Royal Ascot. But enough on that. I think John's comments is spot on. I think Royal Ascot is an event rather than a race meeting. It's something that everyone's drawn to. I think the fact that there's 5-2 average favourites makes no difference. The fact that there's 7 races makes no difference. And all those little talking points that we think, I think it's a huge event and people just want to be there. And that's a massive part of it, as you say, with the royal procession and such. But that's the appeal it's got. But I think something else that Royal Ascot do very well is variety. Mm. So whether you want to have the huge regalia and dress up and go in the royal enclosure if you're lucky to be invited, or indeed pay big money for hospitality and being served by 5-star Michelin chefs, there's that option. But there's also £25, go in the middle of the track, bring your own food and drink if you want. Mm. Great, that's an option that's not always available. So there's a huge variety. And I think one of the successes, having been there myself this year, first time I've been there for a while, speaking to racegoers, is a lot of racegoers have routine. So they like to do the same thing year on year, whether that's go to the picnic enclosure or go to a certain day. And they've built that routine up over time. And I think that's a huge part of it, in that people have got into a tradition of going and going to the area which suits them and what their needs are. A final point about the crowds this year, no World Cup and no Euros. Mm. Which often dictates what people are watching, what's their interest in. So perhaps people's mind are a bit more open to going racing. But Royal Ascot as well, it's a very special place. Like, it's pretty majestic. It looks brilliant. The facilities are top notch. There's a real draw to it. I mean, we talk about Cheltenham. I think Cheltenham's the most beautiful race course when you look out. The stands facilities are pretty average. Like,
yeah,
it's not much to look at. You look at the grandstand, you
agree.
Think,
I took a wander around Ascot one day before the doors opened, and seeing it without anyone there just gives you a real appreciation for not just the scale of it, but the quality of how they present the track, the variety of areas, the sheer number of staff. I mean, I don't know how many staff they had there, but it's many, many, many thousands. And those staff are also, has to be said, very welcoming. You know, they ensure that people coming there feel that they're a glamorous event. They just do it well, don't they?
They do, and I think the problem Cheltenham has is it's had this, the kind of, it gets rolling, doesn't it? And it snowballs as maybe there's not value for money, and then that takes on a life of its own, and then it's almost, it can't get away from that perception. Whereas value for money has just never even been a consideration, really, at Royal Ascot. It's the creme de la creme. It's going to cost an absolute fortune, and no one bats an eyelid, because that's part of it. It's a different audience, I think, to Cheltenham, and I think it, as a result, it's more robust, perhaps.
One of the big talking points, of course, of the week was how bloody hot it was. it was toasty, over 30 degrees some days, and Ascot did not relax the dress code. This became quite a thing, and indeed they were insisting people on the gates turning up without socks, had to buy socks. Some racegoers were taken ill. There were dozens who required some medical treatment or another. What do you think, James? Should they be more relaxed on this point, or is the Royal Ascot dress code part of the tradition?
It's a load of absolute nonsense. Plain and simple. I mean, weather gets hot, people are hot, they've gone for a day to enjoy themselves. I get there's an old tradition and people want to be encouraged to be dressing up nicely, but if you're too hot, take your jacket off. It's plain and simple. Like, the idea that everyone's got to sit and suffer because this is Royal Ascot, it's come on. People are paying good money to go there, people are there for a day out. It's not spoiling someone else's enjoyment if you take your jacket off and you're too hot, and it's just madness. I mean, Sockgate, I mean, it's just a crazy story, isn't it? There's always one crazy story. I don't know. I mean, is that really necessary to spoil someone's day and just say, no, you need to buy a pair of socks? I don't know. I feel that these traditions are a bit archaic. If you're really bothered by somebody else not wearing socks on a race course, maybe you should go and get some more hobbies. But yeah, I think it was just crazy. And stories like this put people off racing. People will watch Royal Ascot and feel maybe this isn't for them. Those sort of stories might encourage it.
What do you think, Mr. Formality, John Harding?
Where's that come from? I was just checking to see if you're wearing socks. I think it's part of it, isn't it? And I think look at the crowds. That dress code's been the same for years, and still we had, the crowds are up this year, so it doesn't bother enough people for it to be an issue. At the same time, that rare commodity of common sense, if it goes over 30, maybe just some relaxation. Not that they would ever call it a relaxation, but some common sense maybe. I think the whole sock thing's probably a bit too far. At the same time, you know, that's the event that you're signing up to go to, and those are the rules, so you don't have to go.
Yeah. Well, there we go. The biggest issue of all dealt with.
I think the language is the way. I mean, if they were to say you don't necessarily have to keep your jackets on, but you're actively encouraged to, it just makes it a bit more friendly. But I get the idea about tradition, but there's got to be some bit of sensibleness to all of it.
I think even if they relax the dress code, people would still turn up and wear the same things and be just as smart and be just as rigid with it. I think that's part of it.
As the jockey club has found out, having relaxed their dress code.
People still wear suits to the jockey club ones.
Justice to the sockless.
Well, there we go. We have done all the big talking points for Royal Ascot. We've absolutely rattled through an amazing 5 days. Just one final point to end on. Could Royal Ascot improve?
Always room for improvements. The two I thought possibly were potentially a start time a little bit earlier. 2:30 is quite an early start. I don't know how it works with ITV and getting their lunchtime news in. Another one which came up to me, a friend of mine suggested this, a credit to him, was that perhaps the Royal Procession could try and get a few more big names that would draw in. So, for example, the example I was given was last year Taylor Swift was performing all over the UK. She's obviously a huge name. She brought £1 billion into the economy. How easy would it be to persuade her, come to Royal Ascot, you're in the Royal Procession with the King and Queen, and you get a day at Royal Ascot? Probably wouldn't be hard to turn that down. And suddenly, where's that story going? Everywhere. That story's going everywhere. So maybe they should try and up their game with who's in the carriages to really sell it. But it's great to see all the celebrities on prize-giving duties, in fairness.
Let's hope Buckingham Palace are watching. John, what do you think?
Fewer socks. No, I think the Saturday, the Saturday's always been the debate, hasn't it? Because it's got the biggest audience yet. Probably the weakest racing. I don't entirely know how to fix that. That is for minds greater than mine, I think. I wouldn't move the Gold Cup there. I'd leave that. I just think maybe the Saturday, if they were looking at the programme, that would be the one that maybe needs a little bit of love. But I'm slightly clutching at straws. I just think it's great.
There we go. What a note to end on. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate all your views and insights. And thank you very much to you at home for joining us and indeed for tuning in all last week as we covered what a glorious week of racing it was. We'll be back again next Monday with all the latest racing news and views. Until then, goodbye.